want to kind of go back to the beginning a little bit of the 12 steps and talk about this concept of powerlessness that's in step one. Step one, in Alcoholics Anonymous, it says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And in other programs, of course, we substitute other words for alcohol. And again, I think there can be a kind of resistance to this idea of powerlessness if you have this Buddhist orientation of, oh, well, it's about me making effort and I'm not a victim or I'm not helpless. But I do think that it can be helpful as an orientation when we sit down to meditate and we start to find all these thoughts just coming through and sensations and experiences in the body just kind of coming up, to start kind of with a perspective of I'm powerless over this stuff. Because that naturally leads to a kind of surrender and acceptance of this is true, this is what's happening. My job isn't to control this or stop this or make it be the way I want it to be. But it also doesn't mean that I can't change things at all. Now, this is another one of the paradoxes of spiritual practice. Right? That on the one hand, we have to learn acceptance. But on the other hand, we have to engage in effort. I think that our habitual way as human beings of dealing with life, of this, what comes at us through our mind and body, through our sense contact, is to try to control it. And that's a natural thing. I mean, that's just a survival mechanism. And that's if we didn't do that, of course, we'd be in trouble. You know, if when we were hungry, we didn't eat because we just accepted hunger, you know, eventually we'd just starve to death. If when we had sexual longing, we never engaged in sex, the species would die out. So responding to these stimuli, these cravings, is what keeps a species functioning, or keeps it going. But the problem is that when we start to look inside and see our moment-to-moment experience, we see how that, as a moment-to-moment strategy, creates what the Buddha called dukkha, or suffering, or an unsatisfactoriness. Or in the 12-step world, we can talk about being restless, irritable, and discontent. That's dukkha. So I think that our instincts don't prioritize our comfort. Our instincts prioritize survival. Evolution doesn't really care if we're happy as long as we procreate. Yeah. As long as we just create more of ourselves, right? That's this incredibly powerful force of life. So we're facing that energy when we sit down to meditate. We're facing it, we're trying to move somewhat against it, as in Noah Levine's book, Against the Stream, is a quote that he pulled from the Buddhist teachings. We're going against that stream of whether you want to call it of evolution or of survival or instinct. or going against all those energies. So we have to really recognize when we sit down that there is this powerful stuff that we can't control, and then figure out how to work with it. And the starting point then is doing nothing, right? Is accepting things as they are. It's not the end point. Again, and I think this is one of the misunderstandings that comes up in the kind of just mindfulness world, where mindfulness is just taught as a separate practice, that, oh, just accept everything. And that's, I don't think that's a workable strategy in life, you know, to accept everything. But if we start out by trying to control everything and change everything and make it the way we want, that's not a workable strategy either. So we're in this conundrum, this paradox, but which can be characterized as what the Buddha called the middle way. We start with this acceptance of just seeing how are things. This is the way it is. And then we say, now what? And that's how we proceed into the path. So we need that power of acceptance, that power of openness, of non-resistance, of non-controlling, of surrendering, before we can move wisely into making choices, before we can, I would say, kind of trust our response. So I'm just going to page break now, dot, dot, dot. I want to move into an exercise. Around self-judgment. I think because I so often run into people struggling with this, and it's such an impediment to our recovery, to our meditation practice. I mean, there's already several questions have been somewhat tinged with the "I'm not doing it right," the sort of feeling maybe in the background. So I'm going to ask you to talk with a partner. And Teresa, you're excused from this. You don't have to do it. She was telling me last night how she hates doing small groups. Don't we all? That's why I had to become a teacher, so I wouldn't have to participate in the small groups. But I've also benefited tremendously from working in that way. And I also like to break the structure, the form of the authority and the students that we set up, which is a valuable form, but particularly in the 12-step world, we know the value of hearing our own voices. And since we can't all speak to the whole room at the same time, we'll break into, I think, dyads. So I want to talk before we do that, before we break into the dyads and I give you this exercise, I'm going to talk about mindful speech itself as a practice. Because this is really one of the biggest challenges for most people who engage in Buddhism and start to try to take on what the Buddha was teaching and realize how difficult it is to just do this simple act of speaking skillfully. I've even heard it said that the precept on right speech is the one that's most commonly broken in monasteries by the monks. And so that points to the challenge of And it also hopefully points to us being forgiving of ourselves for our failings in this regard. Nonetheless, we want to explore this and see how we can cultivate right speech. It's so valuable in all kinds of communication, but it's particularly valuable, I think, in an environment of where we're trying to help each other, such as a 12-step environment. First I'll talk about a little bit about mindful listening. I think that's equally important to mindful speech, and it'll be half of what you're doing in this exercise. Mindful listening, first of all, means that instead of, for instance, paying attention to your breath, as you might in meditation, you're paying attention to your partner and what they're saying. And when your mind wanders from that, you just come back to listening to your partner and what they're saying. When you have a thought of comparing, like, oh, I've had that happen to me and that you want to say, you let go of that and you come back to listening. When you start rehearsing what you're going to say to them, you let go of that and come back to listening. So it's really just like a concentration practice. There's nothing to do except be an open, receptive vessel for what they're saying. You don't have to do anything. One of the things that can facilitate that is keeping some attention in the body. So feeling yourself sitting, however that's easiest for you, whether that's kind of feeling your butt on the chair or whether it's feeling your feet on the floor or feeling your breath going in and out, something that just helps you to connect with the here and now through the body. A very effective way of being grounded. So that's the simple but not easy practice of mindful listening. And we'll talk more about it after the exercise as people share. A mindful speech, certainly for me, is very challenging. And the way I like to characterize the challenge of mindful speech is that my ego is made up of my thoughts. And when I open my mouth to speak, I speak my ego. Yeah, those are the thoughts that I'm speaking. So somehow I have to kind of intervene between my ego and my mouth. And that's the work of mindfulness, is to stop, breathe, and see what's coming up, and then bring my higher wisdom into play to make sure, first of all, that what I'm saying is true. And in the Buddhist prescription for a right speech is to be true, to be timely. This is a good time to say it. And to say something that's useful and kind, not harsh. Now, in this exercise, it's automatically timely because we're doing a speech exercise. So you don't have to worry about that one. And you're not even really responsible for being helpful or kind because you're really doing this for yourself. So the main one you just have to deal with is truth. Easy. The problem being, of course, that when we actually ask ourselves what is true, we'll find that a lot of the things that we think of as being true are actually just opinions. So one of the things that I try to do is to temper my language. Recognize that language is very powerful and has a conditioning effect of its own. So that when I say something like, I'm an angry person, I am solidifying that belief. Whereas if I say, I often get angry, it's very different. Yes, it's a recognition, but it also implies impermanence. And it's not saying that's who I am. It's just that this is a behavior that appears from time to time. So noticing how you use language to solidify and make real, and seeing if you can let go of that and use language that is more accurate, which often means to This is a hard concept for me. The word, there's good, some good words for it, but I forget them often. But kind of making, somebody help me if you have, if you know what I'm trying to think of. But it, okay. No mind readers? So the idea is that instead of saying, just, you know, I'm an angry person, I seem to get angry a lot. So I find that seem to is very helpful. Often, you know, it feels as if, you know, those kind of ways of modifying what I'm saying rather than saying it is this way. Because the verb to be is like an equal sign, right? And anytime I use that verb, I'm saying this is the way things are. This is, these two things are equal. This is a fact. And so just be very careful with that. And just doing that forces you to slow down in your speech and forces you to explore what you're saying a little bit more. And that then helps you to stay more in your body. So you want the same approach in terms of being present in your body so that you're here now. You're not off there and sort of out of your body when you're speaking. If you can, so one of the ways I like to characterize this is speaking from the heart rather than from the head. And some people actually find it helpful to put their hand on their heart as they speak. And it can really, it can make a very automatic change in how you speak because your attention immediately gets drawn to that place. And when we speak from here, there's some other energy. Not to be too new agey about it. So, mindful listening, mindful speech. What we're going to do is each person's going to have about 5 minutes to speak. I'll ring a bell. At the end of 5 minutes, we'll stop, we'll take a breath, we'll switch. I'm going to give you a question. That's the last thing I do so that you won't be rehearsing. But I just want to see if, and you'll just pair up with somebody who's near you and just turn and face each other. And you'll want to speak in a moderate tone. So you're going to want to sit close together because there's a lot of people in a small space and it will get really loud if you're trying to, you know, speak really loud. So those are the housekeeping aspects of it. So I just want to see if there are any questions about this process. I don't actually expect you to remember everything I've said because I've been talking for like 10 minutes about something. It's like, what? How was I supposed to be mindful? But this is practice. So any questions? Yes.
So was what you were saying, was it sort of to stay away from like absolute language? Like I always,
yes, exactly. Being careful.
Pigeonholing myself.
Yes. Yes. Very good. Thank you. Absolute language, pigeonholing. Yep. Not that I've ever had a pigeon in a hole, but I'm not sure what that involves. It's, I think, from an earlier era. So someday we'll be talking about, people will be talking about spam, and they, I mean, of course, we already have that spam problem. The meat, it seems, some of you probably don't even know about that. But anyway, so why don't you... Well, I'm finding my question. You turn it to someone nearby and find a partner. And if it turns out that we have an uneven number of people in the room, we'll solve that. Does everyone have a partner? You need a partner? Why don't you join these guys so you can have a three-way? I need a louder bell. I'm glad you've jumped into mindful speaking so quickly. So let me give you the suggested topic to explore, if I may. And see how loud it gets. This is about exploring self-judgment. And it's got two basic parts. What ways do you judge yourself negatively? And what would it look like if instead of judging yourself or trying to fix yourself, you accepted yourself as you are? This doesn't mean that you condone destructive behavior in your life, but it's really more about your self-view. So, what ways do you judge yourself negatively? And what would it look like, or what would it mean if instead of judging yourself, you accepted yourself as you are? So decide who's going to speak first. What we're going to do is one person's going to speak for 5 minutes, and then I'm going to ring a bell in 5 minutes.
But I mean, in those that you have.
No, I just want you to, you don't have to be, just, yeah, roll them together, yes. Yes, so you have the opportunity to kind of... So in other words, you want to start out by acknowledging what's true about your self-judgment and then sort of asking yourself in this interaction,